You're listening to Emma Sleaf on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Treaty for me was the very first performance I ever did in Alice Springs. And I believe that was the starting point for me and my dance journey as a dance artist.
So tell me about this performance. What do you remember?
I think it was grade 9. And I was living in Alice Springs, and we had just started dance in high school. We were the first group of students to be introduced to dance as a subject. And myself and my friend Samantha Lawton choreographed this dance, and she's local Indigenous here, and we kind of combined these contemporary movements with her Indigenous background and created this dance. And we were a bunch of Year 9 students from Olsh College in Alice Springs, and we wore these pink bodysuits, and we had our hair painted, and we danced in the Croc Festival, which back then was the bush equivalent of the Rocker Steadford.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and everyone loved it. So there were people, we were on, I think it was Traeger Park. They had a big stage, and there were just community everywhere sitting, watching, and performed it, and the audience loved it. And that was the song that kind of started my journey.
Did you know immediately after dancing for that first time in your pink outfit that you had found something that you would continue doing?
Yeah, well, my drama teacher / dance teacher at the time, Bryn Williams, he nurtured this creativity and this freedom to be able to do things outside of the ordinary. So I really got a chance to, through my high school years, to create things that were of my own making, and he really nurtured that creativity. And I think my time with him through high school, and then after high school, I did a bit of work with him then. Yeah, were the fundamental steps. I learnt so much from him.
And what did you love about dance? What was it that really grabbed you right from the start?
I think I've been dancing since I was a child, and I did like the typical 80s dance school. But then when I moved to Alice Springs, it became something different, and it became about culture, and it came about expression and new ideas, and I was experiencing things I'd never done before. So we moved into like contemporary dance and also hip hop as well, because we were young. and the work I started to do as a choreographer kind of led into these different areas I'd never experienced or been trained in. So I had to be from Alice Springs and try and educate myself in those forms and learn, which luckily YouTube was just starting out then. Mm-hmm. So I could like log on and find some really corny dance stuff. But yeah, it started, and it fueled the passion. And I think it was all about music and sharing things that make people happy. So whether it was teaching kids who needed something good in their day, or whether it was performing for people who really got something out of what you were giving them. I think that's what I love about dancing.
When you were a child, were you quite extroverted, bound to end up being a performer, do you think?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
I was not shy as a child. I grew up in a fitness center, so my mum was an aerobics instructor, and I think I was always around a lot of people, and my dance school as well. I was not shy. My mum made all the costumes for the dance school, so I would like model the costumes, and you know, I just wasn't a shy kid. But as I got older, I think it changed a bit, and I was really confident through high school. But I was also alternative. I think I wasn't like a super mainstream popular kid, because I had all these creative and kooky ideas. I spent a lot of time at school in my final years when I was a good student and in that drama studio or at Araluen or in the art studio, just creating things. So.
Mm. Tell me a bit more about your childhood before you came to Alice Springs. Whereabouts did you grow up and what are some of your memories of that time?
I grew up on an island called Bribie Island, which is on the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, just north of Brisbane. So it was completely opposite to Alice. I spent half of my childhood there, so beaches and... Yeah, I have really fond memories that we had a really simple life. We weren't well off by any means, but we were on the beaches every weekend and my mum and dad ran a squash courts and fitness centre, so we were there all the time as well with them. They worked really hard. I danced and played squash, obviously, because my dad was the coach, so I had to... do that, yeah.
So both parents pretty fit and active by the sounds of it.
Yeah, definitely, always, yeah.
And brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I've got two brothers and also were squash players as well. So we would follow Dad around. He eventually became the junior development officer for Queensland, for Squash Queensland, and he would run a junior formula tournament around Brisbane and we would travel every weekend and go to different suburbs in Brisbane and play squash.
It sounds like the perfect childhood. I'm still coming to terms with the fact that you grew up on Bribie Island.
Yes.
How does that even happen?
Somehow I end up in the desert. Well, it was squash that brought me here. So my dad ended up getting a job at the squash courts in Alice Springs and at that point, we moved here, packed our whole lives into this tiny little red Sigma. There was five of us in the car and this cat. We had a cat. And we drove over in 1996. And that year was New Year's. There was a locust plague. And we were in Longreach, I think, on New Year's. And there were just millions of locusts everywhere.
Oh.
And, yeah, we ended up in Alice Springs. And I don't... think I've ever looked back. I've been here pretty much ever since.
What do you remember about what must have been a pretty epic road trip?
Yeah, it was the bugs.
The bugs.
It was and the cat. I have this image of my in my mind in being in the back seat and looking forward and the cat sitting in between my parents in the front seat.
So the cat got the front seat and the kids in the back, right.
The kids are in the back. Yeah, we camped out. I remember staying at the Devil's Marbles and we camped at the Devil's Marbles on our way through and the cat was on a lead and my dad, we had set up the camping spot. My dad had needed to drive into Tennant to get some supplies and the cat thought that we were leaving him. So he all he saw was the red car drive away and the cat was crying watching this car and then he ran up into the hill into the Devil's Marble. So me and my brothers and my mom we spent hours looking for this cat and then we found him up there and were able to get him back. Yeah, I have the vivid memory of that.
Mm. Yeah. And how did your parents explain to you as kids that you were moving from, you know, this beautiful island, tropical paradise,
right,
to the middle of the continent? Had you even heard of Alice Springs?
I had heard of Alice Springs on like a Saturday morning cartoon show. You know how they have those TV shows back in the 90s and and I just remember seeing this one image of a camel and it must have been the Gap.
Yeah.
And that was my image of Alice Springs. And my dad had come out here for the interview for the job at the Squash Centre. And when he came back, he said to us that it will be... we will see things we've never seen before in Alice Springs. It will be a culture shock to us and it's important to understand and be respectful. He said, you're going to see Aboriginal people basically for the first time in our lives. Like being from the East Coast, it's not, I don't think, culturally it's the same as living in the desert.
Mm.
And that At that time, there were people still sleeping in the river and things like that. So we were going to see things that we'd never seen before. But yeah, that's been a huge part of my life out here as well. So working with Aboriginal people, also my dad's life in Alice after the squash courts and moving on.
The voice you're hearing is dancer and Zumba instructor Sheila Crosley for Old New Borrowed Blue. She has spent over 20 years here in Alice Springs, and right now it is time for your next track. It's the new track.
Yes.
Tell me what you've chosen.
Oh, do you want me to pronounce it with my great Australian accent?
Australian slash Spanish.
Kitira Palante.
That's great.
It's kind of okay.
Yeah, that's...
It's by Daddy Yankee. It's a Zumba track. So I picked it because 2 weeks ago I went to the Gold Coast and I got to dance with the creator of Zumba, who came to Australia to celebrate 10 years of Zumba in Australia.
So you're saying you chose this song because it reminded you of Zumba?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Oh, so much to talk about Zumba. And most people probably know me as the Zumba lady in town. So I get that a lot if I go out somewhere. You're the Zumba lady. I see someone on a dance floor. They're like, you're the Zumba lady. I mentioned earlier I went 2 weeks ago to the Gold Coast where there were 1,200 people in one room doing Zumba at the same time because the creator, Beto Perez, came to Australia to celebrate 10 years of the program here. And this is their new release by Daddy Yankee, who I was just mentioning before was the first person to kind of create the reggaeton movement.
We were talking off air about reggaeton because I was showing off and telling you that I had been to Cuba and everywhere I went, people were talking about reggaeton. Disclaimer, not my favourite genre. But really interesting. Daddy Yankee was the man who started it all.
Yes, he was. And that's something I learned through Zumba. So when we go do our training, Zumba's Latin dance fitness, for anyone who doesn't know what it is. It's the combination of dancing and fitness. And it's all based on Latin rhythms, but there's lots of world rhythms as well in there. And when we do our training to be an instructor, we learn four basic rhythms. We learn reggaeton, we learn cumbia, we learn merengue, and we learn salsa, of course. and we learn the history and where they come from and about the rhythm and about the movements. And they're all really significant. There's a lot of historical things that go into those styles of dancing. And the history from those countries, like we talked about earlier, is really rich. And there's a lot of Afro influence in the music. And there's a lot of, there's so much history that goes into it. And that's a part of what I love about the program. For me, it's not just dancing and having a party, but I have the responsibility of sharing culture with other people that's not necessarily my own, but I respect it and I love it. And I love that this program gives it universally to everybody to do the same thing. It's amazing. Sorry.
Beto Perez, tell me about him. He must be quite a character.
Beto, I've met him a few times actually, and he's actually been to Alice Springs before. So I originally met him about 7 years ago when he came out to Alice Springs, and the kids from Drumatum did a little session with him and worked at Yipirinya at that time, and we all got to have a dance and they played the drums for him. But he has an amazing story, and at this training that I went to 2 weeks ago, he told us his personal story and how Zumba was created and about his upbringing in Colombia. And it was really inspiring. It was amazing.
I bet it was. How have people in Alice Springs responded to the Zumba phenomenon, which you pretty much started and you're celebrating, 10 years of Zumba in Alice?
Yeah, in January it'll be 10 years since I did my training, and February, 10 years since the very first class at the YMCA that had, I think, 100 people standing in front of me. It was the most petrifying thing ever. You talked earlier about whether or not I was always outgoing or destined to be on stage. Mm. But at that point, I've never been more nervous in all of my life.
What were you scared of?
I had never instructed. I had taught dance classes, which is different because you teach one dance for 1 hour and you keep going over something. Mm. Zumba uses the music to move people, so there's no talking. So you have to visually show everybody how to do these steps that, you know, people from Alice Springs have never done a salsa track before, I'm going to say. Like, probably 90% of people have never danced salsa. So, and I hadn't either. Like, I had just learnt all of these things before, like a month before coming and teaching it. So, and I never anticipated the response that we had. And I think it just continued. It was mind-blowing, the Zumba craze. And I think within 2 years I had taught half the population of Alice Springs had been through my classes. Not necessarily every person, but that amount of people, like constant high numbers, for years on end. Yeah, it was amazing.
Now, you got involved with Zumba at a particularly challenging time in your life.
Yeah, it was Zumba. I started Zumba at the after I had my son, my second child. I decided, who am I? What am I doing with myself? And I was in my later 20s at that point, and I decided to figure out who that was. I've had kids now, but what am I going to do? I was teaching dance, and I also was working out in the gym anyway. And an American friend of mine had the original Zumba DVDs, and a group of them were doing them at someone's house in the lounge room. And I was like, wow, this is really amazing. I love that dance is really accessible in this way. I went off and did the training and came back, and it started and it snowballed, like we were just saying earlier. And it was hard, I guess, as well, because it became all consuming for me. So I like to do things really well, and I like to learn. And being in Alice Springs, you have to leave Alice Springs to do that. So being a mum, I was married at that point, and I got married really young. So I was pregnant at 19 and married at 20, and my younger years were dedicated to family and being a good military wife and all of those kind of things. And at that point I decided to figure out who I was, and Zumba came into my life, and I'd also started a dance company called Dusty Feet Dance Collective at that time. I don't think who I was becoming was who he married, and I feel like I blossomed. At that point, I started to really feel like I was who I was. And then I don't think that was necessarily who he had fallen in love with when I was younger. And like, there's a lot of other things as well, but it kind of was probably the start of that. And I focused a lot on giving everything I could to all of these people that were coming to my classes all the time. So it was, yeah, a lot of giving and probably taking away from that part of my life as well. And then, there's been a few other times Zumba has been around during rough periods of time. So, like, when my dad was ill, and I, for many years, I thought I wanted to be a choreographer for Zumba. So they have master trainers, and they have choreographers called Zumba Jammers, and you have to audition for those roles. And I did 3 times, and on the third time I got selected, and there was I think 4 other people in Australia that were selected.
4 in Australia?
Yeah, by Zumba Home Office in Florida and Beto himself. So you video audition, and you become a choreographer for Australia and New Zealand at that point. And we went and trained in Asia, and came back, and I started to travel and teach other instructors. and do workshops and teach masterclasses. So then I kind of put all this extra pressure on as well to do that stuff. Yeah, it was I thought it's what I really wanted, and I did love it too. And I got to meet a lot of people, and I got to do a lot of amazing things. But my family life at that point, my marriage had broken down, and it was abusive and not a very good time. So it was hard to have something that I really wanted to do at the same time as something that I had to go through, and I had to focus on that as well. So yeah, I newly became a single mom at that point, and traveling became impossible, and my dad was sick as well, and just yeah, I ended up giving that up because I couldn't maintain everything that I had to maintain at that time.
We're going to talk a little further about your dad and your mum, both of whom incredibly interesting people, Buddhists,
yes.
I understand, with a very interesting love story.
Yes, yeah.
But first, I want to go to your third track. It's No Ordinary Love. Why did you choose this one?
I love this remake of that song, and I love the original song. So it's not often I love both versions of a song. But Sade reminds me of my mum, and my mum is probably one of the most important relationships in my life. So she's been, yeah, very important person to me, and this song reminds me of her.
I understand that your mum was a bit of a Sade fan.
Yes, mum was. I grew up listening to two Sade albums. I grew up listening to a lot of things thanks to my mum. Mum's originally from Zimbabwe, so she has an eclectic taste in music, world music. So I grew up on a lot of different things, and being an aerobics instructor as well. So all of the best tracks from the 80s.
Oh, I can imagine your mum's playlist back in the day.
Yeah.
When she was teaching aerobics back in the 80s?
Yeah, with the G-strings and everything. It was amazing.
The whole business.
Yeah.
Now, your parents were both Buddhists.
Yeah.
Tell me how they met.
I love their story, and if I could make movies, I would make a movie about it. My mom is from Zimbabwe, and when she was 18, she left to go live in England. And I guess, like young people do, they want to find themselves and travel to do so. And she was, I think, looking for her place in the world, maybe, and she traveled. Backpacked through the Middle East and India, and ended up in Australia. And on that way, I think she'd always been interested in Buddhism, but she kind of really found what she was looking for, and she ended up living in a wat, which is like a Buddhist
temple,
in Sydney, in Australia. At the same time, my dad, he always told me and other people to. Who reflected on him, he was up to no good when he was a young man, and he always said he was a very angry young man. And after his brother passed away, he went on a trip overseas to Asia, and he travelled through Thailand, and he never came back. Well, he did eventually come back, but he ended up becoming a monk, a Buddhist monk in Thailand, and a forest monk. So he lived in the forests of northeast Thailand, spoke the language, was a monk for 7 years, and changed his whole life. And it was a bit confusing, I think, for his family possibly at that time, because it's not something typically a Westerner would do.
Where was his family?
Brisbane, so Australian, okay. Yeah. So my dad, I think, came back, if I'm telling the story correctly, he came back as a monk in Australia because his mum was sick, and he ended up staying at the wat that my mother was living at.
In Sydney. Now, we're talking sort of metro Sydney, or was it out?
I think it was out. Okay. Yeah. Wat Buddha Dharma it was called. And my dad ended up teaching there, and he met my mum, and he said it was love at first sight. And of course, as a monk, that's not something you can pursue, or that's not something you practice. So they stayed in touch. But when he went back to Thailand, he went through changes too in his practice and what he felt was right for him. And he decided, I think eventually 3 years passed, and he disrobed and he came back to Australia and found Mum. And they were together ever since that point. Yeah.
That really is an incredible story.
Yeah.
Your father was a Buddhist monk for 10 years. Your mother, however, did not become a monk. She was just interested in philosophy.
She was a single mum. So she had my older brother at that point. So she also in those days it wasn't easy for a woman to be a single parent, be Buddhist, be a foreigner. And then my dad came back, who was also, he'd chosen a life that was, people didn't possibly understand, and came back obviously with nothing. And they started their lives together, which was challenging. And they had kids, obviously, and my dad ended up changing his last name to my mum's last name because he wanted to be respectful to my brother and make it easy for him in those days not to have to explain why they would have different last names as the rest of the family. So it was something else that people didn't understand either, because I think with Buddhist practice, there's not as much attachment to things. So attachment to names wasn't such a big deal for my parents, but I guess for family it wasn't well understood. But it's definitely something I've respected about my parents and the way that we've been brought up and the things that they've done for us and taught us as just to be good human beings, really.
Did your dad talk to you much about the years that he spent living in Thailand?
He did. Like, our childhood stories were Buddhist stories, and the stories of him living in a cave when he was over there. And that's definitely something I want to go back and revisit. And he spoke the language, and like, to hear him speak Thai, and he could read and write as well. Childhood stories or bedtime stories were Buddhist stories or stories of him when he was a monk. And it was always a really special time for him in his life, which, it's emotional to think about that because, I never got to experience. We had always talked about going there, and my parents ended up, they were married for 30 years, and they ended up, after leaving Alice Springs, retiring in Cairns and living in Laos for part of the year. So they ended up adopting a family over there adopted them, and they sponsored and supported this family. So they would go and live there part of the year and come back to Australia. But a part of that was because Dad could speak Lao, which was similar to Thai, so he could speak the language, picked it up very quickly, and he got to journey back to some of those places he lived at. And so mum got to see those places with him in Thailand, because it's just across the border. And that, I don't know, that was a the things I wish I could have done with him as well, but maybe one day I'll get out there and see those things.
You're listening to dancer and Zumba instructor, amongst many other things, Sheila Crosley for Old New Borrowed Blue. Your father passed away a few years back.
Yeah.
It must have been a really shocking loss for you. Can you talk me through what happened?
Yeah. We've never, as a family, really experienced any loss. So we were kind of on our own a lot too. So no extended family. It was always us. So in my life, I had never experienced anything we've always been really healthy and never, we used to joke, my dad in particular, about never having gone to the doctor, or never being spent a night in hospital, or don't have to go to the dentist, like never broken a bone. And then in 2013, prior to that, he started to have issues with his feet, and he thought he had sprained his ankle or he had problems lifting his foot and it started to drag. And they started to get a little bit worried and went and got some tests done. And then in October of 2013, he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease, which I'd never even heard of before. I didn't know. And they were like, oh, you need to look it up because it's terminal. So I read all about it, and it was like probably the most horrible thing someone could get, having lived a completely healthy life, like always having played sport and like we've been healthy, active family our whole lives. And yeah, just one day your whole world is flipped upside down. So motor neuron disease slowly turns you into a vegetable, basically. So you can be, and it's different for everybody. It can be really quick for some people and it can be a longer period of time for others. So for my dad, it was 18 months from diagnosis. And it was at the end of my marriage also. So at that point, I had decided it was best to get divorced and leave my marriage. And I also needed to go help my mum take care of my dad because he would need full-time care and he did not want to be in hospital or pass away in hospital. So I ended up moving to Cairns with my two kids and we took care of him, which was a beautiful time and a very sad time. And it was sad in many ways. So watching my parents' relationship turn from husband and wife and best friends to patient and carer as well. So much respect for my mum and what she did, yeah, taking care of him. The loss of dignity in that kind of illness was hard for him, but he worked the whole way through. So he started a business with my brother, a solar technology company, and dad would be, he would be on the computer because he could still use his hands, and he would be talking to people on the phone all day, selling, finding out all this information, and
he kept working,
kept going. And then it got to the point where he couldn't pick up the phone anymore, so we got him a Bluetooth earpiece, and he would be on his Bluetooth phone and he could still like click his finger, so he could still move the mouse a bit, and he would do that. He just kept working, and he never complained, and he just accepted all the changes that came, like just from being able to walk to having to be in a wheelchair, you know, having that taken away from you, something really, really quick.
It's all hard these to changes. Imagine, yeah, unless you go through it.
It was sad. It was a sad time, but also lots of funny memories and things too, yeah.
You're saying that you believe that his Buddhist practice, not just the 10 years that he was a practicing monk, but continuing the philosophy throughout his life helped him?
Yeah, both my parents. He ended up doing a lot of research on Buddhism, the origins of Buddhism and the Buddha. And he was doing research about where he possibly was at that point. So he would tell me, he would be researching all day online, and then he would sit there and tell me all about it afterwards. So it gave him things also to keep his mind busy. His practice allowed him to accept a lot of things that were happening to him. And same with my mum. Yeah, he never complained and he just took everything in its stride and accepted what was happening and plan forward. We just did the best that we could for him, yeah, to make it all right.
Your final song, Scylla, is a Ben Harper song. It's called Waiting on an Angel. It's the live version.
Ironic, really, because he's Buddhist and they believe in reincarnation, which he did. But this song, I love this whole album. And the morning after he was I heard of his diagnosis and I knew that it was terminal. I went to the gym, as I did at that point, to work out my stresses and listened to this. And I just remember sitting on the bench, breaking down, crying. Yeah, so this song for me is sad for the connection to that news in my life.